Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And unto them were sons born after the flood, the sons of Japheth: Gomer, Magog, Madai, Yavan or Ivan or John, Tubal, Meshech, like Moscow, and Tires, like Tyre or like Etruscan. And the sons of Gomer, now he's the first one in the list we just read, out of Japheth. So now Japheth had a whole bunch of sons. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 sons. Now the first son of the seven, Ashkenaz, Riphath or Riphat, and Togarma. And now you look at another one of the sons, but they're obviously not all listed here. And the sons of Ivan or John or Javan, Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, Dodanim. But these were the isles of the Gentiles. Now, see, they didn't list the rest. So just two of the sons are listed. But these were the isles of the Gentiles. So the isles of the Gentiles, in other words, their islands where they were, divided in their lands, everyone after his tongue, after the families in their nations. So when the world was set up after the flood, 1656 years into the world, then the imagination of man's heart was evil continually. So God flooded the whole earth, destroyed all mankind, and saved one man and his family. The man's name was Noah. We're not told what Mrs. Noah's name is. And then he had three sons, and we're not told their names either, their wives, but the sons, we were told. So mankind was split into three parts. Those that were children of the oldest, Japheth, he's listed first. The second oldest, Shem, and the youngest, Ham. So the land of Ham is normally Africa, but not completely. And the land of Japheth, the oldest son, is normally Europe, but not completely. And the children of the middle son, the second son, is Shem, the name. And Shem's family mostly stayed in the Near East, where they still are to this day, only because they were bad and didn't obey God. They were scattered throughout Japheth and Ham, but mostly Japheth. So mostly the Jewish people are found everywhere in the world, but mostly they're among the Japhethites, the Europeans, and so on. So God divided the earth into these three families, and after the flood, you'll remember that God told Noah and his boys to spread out. Fill the earth, multiply, because that was the original plan. And so God obviously wants us weak and divided to lessen the chance for sin. When we're united, we imagine we're strong, and so we build cities to defy God. So city building is something that Cain and Abel, but Cain was the first city builder. And Abel, more or less, was agricultural, living in tents. So God prefers tents and agriculture because whenever man comes together, that's where you get an abundance of crime, corruption, and the laws will become evil and oppressive and despotic. Thomas Jefferson understood that, and felt that America's best hope was to stay agricultural, but it's been a deliberate policy of our government to become urban. And now one of the last bastions in Texas here is for the five city centers to dominate the rural areas and pull them under their wickedness and so on. Now, it isn't that farmers are less wicked than city dwellers, it's just that they don't live as close. When you concentrate people, you concentrate power, you concentrate harlotry, you concentrate thievery, you concentrate all of the evil side of man, you do not concentrate his better moments, even though we would say there were lots of advantages to it. And civilization is built then out of civil, which refers to city. So cityization is civilization. So God is showing here that from the beginning mankind rebelled against him and decided to do things his own way. And instead of spreading out, scattering, and filling the earth, they decided to gather, stay together, and not split up, and not be vulnerable, and not be dependent on God. Why spread out where it's scary when you can gather together and secure yourself? So security is more important than liberty. And you see today that America has decided to go the way of security rather than liberty. When you choose that, you choose slavery. You choose to let go of your liberties in favor of securities. When you have securities, you don't need God, and your liberties disappear because you don't need God. So the destruction of the Greek Empire was when they traded liberty for security. And the role of Alexander the Great was to pull all the world together under one city, which was the ancient pattern of Nimrod and the Tower of Babel. Rome followed in her steps, adding iron and clay to the mix. When the kingdom of God comes, the kingdom of man will fail and falter and be destroyed because iron does not mix with clay. The iron is the power of that government which is under common law. Clay is the non-mixable civil law under which man doesn't need God but does his own thing, goes his own way, and everything ends up in destruction. So, the sons of Ham, which is the youngest son, Cush, which means black in the Hebrew language, Mitzrayim, which means Egypt, Phut, and very interestingly, Canaan. So, Cush's younger brother, all being sons of Ham, Chem, his younger brother Mitzrayim is Egypt. Cush is really Ethiopia, and Egypt is really what they call Lower Egypt, because Upper Egypt, which is in the south, is up toward the mountains, Abyssinia. It's the black part of Africa. And at a certain point early in the history, the Cushites dominated, came down the hill toward the Mediterranean Sea and dominated the other brother, Mitzrayim. And it was said to join those two lands, the red land and the black land, it was said they each had their own hat, their own helmet, that the king of the south said, you know, I've been troubled by the hippopotamuses at night, and I can barely sleep. And because of that, he went up and made war. That is, he went down and made war on the delta, which was the original capital of Lower Egypt. So this family is a battling family, but you notice the youngest of the youngest brother was Canaan. Now, Canaan, or Canaan, as we call it, is the land of Israel. Interesting. Now, the land of Israel then was really brother to Ethiopia and brother to Lower Egypt, Mitzrayim, and that's where the pharaohs come from. But in Ethiopia and in Mitzrayim, Egypt, you have another culture with which they trade because they're brethren. But the Cush, oldest son of Chem, is black, but the youngest son is white. That indicates that the mother and father were divided. One was black and one was white, or lighter and darker. And so the Canaanites are not black at all. And if you remember in the Bible, it is said that cursed be Canaan, the youngest son of Ham, not Ham, and not the black man at all, but the white man. So that son was the one that later God removed for its debauchery, for its idolatry, for its immorality, for its injustice, and put his people and made that the holy land. So God will take an unholy land and turn it into a holy land. God will take that which is turned from him and break it. Because God will not be defeated, and his beneficiary, his purposes, will not be destroyed. And therefore we are safe if we are God's beloved. If you in fact are holy, then you'll be protected by the holy God. But if in fact you are unholy and unrepentant in your unholiness, then God will leave you to your own devices. And you will be destroyed, not only in this world, but in the next. So the sons of Cush, now this is the oldest brother, the black. You'll notice it'll say Seba like Sheba, and Havilah, the land of gold, could be down as far as Zimbabwe. Sabta, Ra'ama, Sabteka, Ra'ama, but a different Ra'ama, Sheba, and Dedan. So you notice that Cush has a lot of kids. So these are the black races, and they spread all over the continent of Africa and particularly settled around rivers and mineral deposits. And so they carried on a lively trade in later in ivory tusks and in salt and in various products that they would then ship all over and trade with the rest of the world. The history of the world is in this one chapter, and it still defines the world today. So even though it looks like history, this is actually extremely relevant for what's going on in the world today, that there are three families. No anthropologist today would follow these three, but anthropologists are wrong, and these three are accurate. So where they settled geographically and where they eventually ended up historically are seeded here in the 10th chapter of Genesis. And Cush begat Nimrod. So now we've moved through Japheth's sons. We only mentioned two out of the seven, the oldest boy, and those were interesting names. You can trace the modern world today out of those sons. In fact, the names of nations are found in the names of these eponyms, which means these heads of families, like Japheth, is Jupiter. Now, Jupiter is a planet, but Jupiter is also a god. And therefore, you can tell what part of the world they settled in, where Jupiter became one of the great ancestors, and ancestors have a way of becoming gods. After people die, they take on a little bit of a higher aura. So even though in this world you're not recognized for your goodness, as soon as you die, people will add a little bit of recognition to you, and your children and grandchildren will say, oh yeah, those, and they don't even know who you are, what you like at all. But still, everybody attains to godness after you perish. And I always give appropriate sermons to that effect, for which I'm paid greatly. And Cush begat Nimrod, verse 8, and he began to be a mighty one in the earth. What an understatement. So now, we didn't yet get to the family of Shem, the middle child. How many know the middle child is often a troublous child? The second child, the middle child, often a troublous child. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
You're thinking of your brother? Yeah, exactly. It is quite literal. But something interesting, the middle child is often the spiritual child. The oldest child is often the royal child. And the youngest child is always the spoiled child. Most beloved. So the history of the world is that God gives kingship to Japheth, but he gives spiritual priesthood to Shem. And if you study it carefully, you'll see that always that order is maintained throughout the scripture. So, rule is given to the eldest son, primogenitor. So, that concept, the Americans stopped when they hit the American border and refused to have aristocracy grow up here as it was in England. And so they ended that based on the Bible. Because God always used the second son to bring blessing to mankind, because the first son usually followed the third son. I won't tell you why, but there it is. Now remember, God said, blessed be Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now there he mixed the role up, because he said Shem first, which is the second son, Ham second, which is actually the third son, and Japheth, which is the oldest son. Because Japheth is the mind son. He's the mental son. He's the soulish son. The physical son is always Ham, Chem, the third son. He's the one that does. He's the doer. But the thinker is the second son. Very interesting. Is your brother a thinker? You're actually the thinker? Well, there you have it. A little bit of mix-up there. Japheth is the first, yeah. And so, you have one that's spiritual, the second, one that's intellectual, the oldest, and one that's physical, the doer, gets things done, accomplishes things, doesn't think about it, talk about it, does it. All right. Now, this Nimrod, which is Cush's son, remember, it's Noah, Ham, youngest son, then his son, Cush, then his son, Nimrod. So Nimrod is the, not grandson, but great-grandson of Noah. He's the great-grandson. And so you can see that all mankind is related, one blood. There are not many races. There's only one race, the human race. So anthropologists have lied to you by dividing up, that is, they deliberately did it, by dividing up the world into many races. But there are not many races in the Bible. There's only the human race, and all the world is one blood, meaning do not get a transfusion from an orangutan. Cytochemically, you will die. You can get, however, blood from a black person or a Chinese person or anybody, because they can have the same blood type as you, because there's only one race, the human race. And therefore, there may be type A and O and so on. But the truth is that there's no distinction within each part of the family. All of these types exist. And Nimrod, verse 9, was a mighty hunter. Remember, it said he was a mighty one in the earth. In other words, he was a king. No, he was a king of kings. Exactly the title that Jesus later accepted and was called King of Kings, Lord of Lords. Well, here's Nimrod long before Jesus taking that title, stealing it so that he would be the emperor. He would be a king over lesser kings, over the peoples. He would be the ruler of the world. And all of the titles then in Persia, Babylon, Greece and Rome, and so on, all these titles that they have, they always try to call themselves the king of the universe, or the king of the world, or the king of the four corners of the earth. And so the present ruler of Iran, whatever his name, Jinabob or whatever it is, he also would like to style himself as the king of the four corners of the universe, much like his predecessors in the past, part of the Persian Empire. But the same in Iraq. Nebuchadnezzar took that title, and so did Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein attempted, actually, to rebuild Babylon and reconstitute it under himself, using his picture. That's a funny one. Remember seeing him in that little hole in the ground? There he is, the king of the four corners. He's stuck in a little hole. Hey, can you guys fix these teeth? You remember that? Do y'all remember that photograph? I mean, I thought that was amusing. This was the guy that was going to rebuild Babylon when God said it couldn't be rebuilt. But what is that? What is that? Who cares what God says? Well, God does. And when I saw him in the hole, the last laugh was on him. Cannot do what God hath said you cannot do. God always wins. He's a little bit smarter, tougher, stronger, and determined. But I thought it was courageous of Saddam Hussein to set out to defy God, just like Osama bin Laden, who will end up also in a hole. Y'all following me? History doesn't change. Nothing is new under the sun. The world is as it was and never will alter or change, no matter what. Now, this is the man, Nimrod. Now, I want to go to the board and write his name, because his name is an interesting name, and you'll understand why the Ten Commandments are a contrast. Nimrod is a builder, and he built what they call ziggurat. A ziggurat is a temple, often with several layers, like a stair step up or a pyramid. But in the land of Nimrod, they would build it without a face on it, and so it would have these steps going up toward heaven. And it was like a ladder or a stairway to heaven. And they would study up there the sun, the moon, the stars. And so they didn't need God, because they could study up here like the zodiac. They could study these stars and could control the weather and could control knowledge and could know what heaven was up to, and they meant by heaven not God, but they meant the natural heavens. And so they studied them so that if the world ever again were flooded, they could have advance notice and so on and so forth. And so they built them rather high so that even if the little hut down here that Jack built would be flooded, it wouldn't reach to the top. And they built their temples then up on the tippy top. And these temples were idolatrous. They worshiped false gods, idolatry, and immoral, because all morality in the world stems from idolatry and injustice. Excuse me. Because all injustice stems from immorality, which stems from idolatry. Now, I'm leading up to the Ten Commandments here by showing you something. If you get your religion wrong, you will get your morality wrong, you will get your politics wrong. If you get your religion right, you will get your morality right, and you will get your politics right. Now, today, there is a battle on all three fronts. And Nimrod set up the original pattern to oppose God. Watch his name. By the way, ziggurat is another name for height or mountain. So these were called, in the Bible when you read, the mountain of the Lord. That's Mount Zion. But here is the other mountain. These ziggurats, which are in South America, China, pagodas, Japan, they're everywhere in the world, but especially you find them all over the Near East, the pyramids of Egypt and so on. They're always high worship centers, and they represent the sun, moon, and stars, and so on and so forth. In other words, trying to replace God with the natural heavens, worshiping the creature rather than the creator, Romans 1. So idolatry, immorality, and injustice is the opposite of what God put in his Ten Commandments. The true worship of God, 1, 2, 3, and 4 commandments, and then the morality that would follow and the justice that would be the fruit of moral people. So many of you have committed idolatry, and therefore you have committed immorality, and therefore you have committed injustice. You have to do the first in order to arrive at the second, in order to produce the third. If you reverse it and get your heart right with God, 1, 2, 3, and 4, then you have the antidote to the Nimrodian system. Why teach this? Because it not only was in the beginning, it is now, and never shall be in the future. It will soon end. But right now, the world is being conquered by civil law that Nimrod started. Now let's look at Nimrod's name. Nimrod has a very interesting name. I'll write it in black so you can see it. The first part of his name, N-M-R. Don't think of the vowels for a moment, because in the ancient world, the vowels weren't always expressed, but the consonants were. Nimr is the first part of his name, and Merid, M-R-D, is the second part of his name. Now, this being common, the M-R is in both of them. So the N prefix and the D suffix. Now, Nimr is the word for leopard. Leopard, leopard. Now remember, his father was Cush, the black. It's translated in the Bible as Ethiopian. But Cush is the founder of all human civilization after the flood. So Cush is the one that is the founder, and I told you he's from Ethiopia, and yet he didn't start there. He actually started up through his son. He started, and he set up another system in the world, which is code law. And so he rebelled from God's commandments, even though the commandments hadn't been written on stone. They had already been written on the human heart, because everybody that's born into the world has the law of God written on his heart, to not injure your neighbor, to be kind to your neighbor, to be good, to worship God, to worship the neighbor. First part of the Ten Commandments, second part. Now, Nimrod was the rebellious leopard. In other words, he was a leopard, quickly to make, you know, to go here and go there without God's approval, and to rebel against or turn against and not submit to God. So Nimrod was the first king of kings and lord of lords, and he not only was the king of Babylon and Assyria and all of the great cities of the world, which he set up. He set them up all the way from the east to the west, from the north to the south. You say, well, how could that be? Well, first of all, they lived a long time after the flood. Shem lived a long time after the flood. Noah lived a long time after the flood, and hundreds of years. So Nimrod is also the name Narmer. Narmer, or Nemes, is the first king or pharaoh of Egypt when it was united. So he is the first, it's the same, N-R-M, it's got all the same letters in it, M-M-R. Narmer or Nemes, the first pharaoh, is the one who united. So this mighty hunter is bigger than you imagine. He's not just a hunter, one who hunts dinosaurs or oxen, the aurochs, or leopards or anything else. And so the symbols of ancient kings are often animals, like the lion or the leopard or the bear or the eagle or whatever. And Nimrod was known as the one that led the world, and they would use these symbols. One of his symbols, we have a picture of Nimrod. We know exactly what he looks like. We don't have to guess. We know his features. We know that he was very tall, a muscular, tall, almost like a Nilotic African, extremely tall and powerful. And we know what he did. We have writings about him and so on outside the Bible. So we know that he chopped up heads of people and piled them up in piles and clubbed them with his club. And he was a very vicious man. So he didn't just hunt animals. He was a mighty hunter of people. And when he hunted you down, you were not spared. Now, I won't go into the long history of that. It's the same as the Egyptian story of Osiris. It's just another name for Nimrod. It's also in the Bible. He's called Baal, the owner, the husband, the Lord, the master, the ruler. And so Baal is the god that Israel was told, do not worship this god. And so when they went into the land of Canaan, you remember he was the younger brother of Nimrod and Mitzrayim and Phut, he dominated his own family, then he dominated the two other families of the earth. He dominated Shem's family as well. And so Noah was told, spread out. But Nimrod said, stay together. I tell you, there is a guy that could defy the living God. Isn't that awful? He defied God. Thank God none of us are like that. You know, this is a man that deliberately, knowingly, consciously deceived everybody and made himself a ruler when God was the ruler. But he made himself the ruler, not only the political ruler, you know, unjust, but also the religious ruler. He was the Pontifex Maximus. He was the high priest. He was a priest king. He was everything. He was the great and mighty Nimrod. So Nimrod set up his kingdom over all the earth. And if you'll read all the cities he started in the Bible, If you read all the cities, Kalna and so on, he just established one city after another, all in the land of Shinar, which is nothing more than Sumer. The land of Shinar is the first civilization after the flood, and we've dug it up. And it's not all dug up yet. As soon as this war with Iraq and Iran is over, I'm going to go back and take some of my Iraqi friends and have them show me where all these sites are, because it'll be fun to go there. And right now they're fighting in places like Samarra. You hear that on television now, and you don't know where that is. Ah, I know the iconography of Samarra. I know the forms of their pyramids and the kind of sarcophagi they have, and so on and so forth. You know, it's a fascinating place. Some of the oldest pottery in the world, Samarraware, and all of this is very familiar to me. And so I've studied these ancient civilizations and all of their pots and their designs and their textiles and the great things that they did. Well, Nimrod was powerful. This guy was powerful, and he claims to have invented fire and the wheel and all kinds of things. Well, actually, it came over on the boat. Noah had brought the books of the Bible. He had bought the 10 books from Adam and from his seed. He had brought those books, and that's how we know the Bible, what Noah brought over. Well, Nimrod got access to that because it was a family thing. And he was able to take it and then just twist it a little bit and pervert it. This is a small change that he made. Instead of God being in charge, he was in charge. That's a very clever thing. And so all of us have a little bit of Nimrod in us, where instead of God telling me what to eat and where to go and what to say and how to dress and how to behave, we just decide for ourselves. That's just a little form of self-government without God. But the Ten Commandments is God's little revenge on that, to say, wait, what are you doing? Well, we're just doing our own thing. Every man does what's right in his own eyes. That's anarchy. But then Nimrod will come and herd you together, bring you all together again. That's called totalitarianism or statism, where the state becomes God, and there is nothing higher than the state. That is taking over Texas right now. That's taking over Louisiana. Oh, it's always been in Louisiana, because that's a civil law state, or a code Napoleon state, which is based upon Justinian's code that was done back in the 600s when the emperor Justinian, the Christian emperor, reduced the Roman laws to civil law and codified everything, just as in the 19th century our Harvard-trained lawyers began to study case law rather than the common law. And so the common law went out of business, but it didn't quite. And we are the last nation on earth to hold strictly to the common law. That's why America is the greatest nation on the face of the earth. It's not because it's big. It's not because it's got nice people. It has nothing to do with all that. It has to do with the Ten Commandments. And now when you take them off the wall, you are defying the living God, just as Nimrod did. See, we don't need any higher law. We don't need to appeal to anything beyond mankind. And mankind wants to be independent of God. The Declaration of Independence from God. But the founders had it the other way. They thought it was the independence from those that were independent from God. King George III, he was a code law promulgator. In other words, he set up the code law instead of the common law of England. And so it was England against England. And those that came to America were those that immediately, when they set up their government, set aside the Roman law, or canon law, or church law, or civil law. And they set up the common law. Because the common law is the law that follows the Ten Commandments. And there's only one nation today on the face of the earth, and it's us. It's our law. And there are those within our midst now that are seeking to overthrow the last vestige of the common law. Will they succeed? Hardly. No more than did Nimrod. No more than did Japan in World War II, or Germany, all code law countries, or Iran, Al-Qaeda, all code law. All the code laws hate the common laws. Because the common law appeals to God, appeals to higher law, appeals to the law of nature, appeals to reason, appeals to morality and justice. So now we have a war that's not only spiritual, but also moral, but also civil. And it's all wrapped up together. And it's tied in with greed. But money itself is not evil. But the love of money is the root of all evil. And so it's interwoven with the witchcraft and the drug trafficking and all of the things that go on in the world today. I thought you would find it interesting to see that God anticipated this happening. And you could study it for yourself in the 10th chapter, where God lays out the geopolitical framework for human society. He was a mighty hunter, verse 9, before the Lord. In other words, even God had to recognize, there is a defiant one. And so Nimrod, this black man, led the world away from God. He not only conquered his own family, he conquered Japheth. Then he conquered Shem. And there was no hope left except God. Now, when you get down to God, you know you're in trouble. But God has a way of always defending his little group. One plus God is always a majority. So there you have it. Why do the kings of the earth conspire together? And why do the rulers of this world gather, set themselves against the Lord and his anointed? There it is. The United Nations. There it is. Nations, not under God, but a United Nations under man, code law. You won't find anywhere in the UN Charter any reference to God. They're going to do morality without God? I hardly think so. I think they'll alter it like the rebellious leopard. It's a pattern that's as old as mankind. It is building again the Tower of Babel. And if you imagine that America should stay in the UN, you are mistaken. And if you think that, you know, maybe that'll go away because we'll finally all just lay down and become slaves, you're mistaken. It's not because I'm going to fight, which I will. It's because God will. And God will back up his own program because he has a stake in it. I don't know why. He likes to make his investments work. I don't know why. He just feels if he puts some effort into something, he wants something back. He's funny that way. And so, today, if you don't feel the tremors of the earth, the Adolf Hitlers rising, the Mao Tse-tungs rising, the Napoleons rising, all of the would-be emperors, the Führers, the great men who would gather together the corners of the universe under themselves as gods, and we as their underlings, no private property will be left, no life will be dear, and no morals will be honored. We'll all be redefined. And you already see it in the school system. If you send your children to school, they're already being brainwashed into the new civil code. Everything is regulation, code. This is all the same language from the beginning of the world. Nothing has ever changed. If you read the Code of Hammurabi, you will discover the difference between that code and Mosaic code. No connection whatever. As a matter of fact, not only no connection, absolutely aware of the other code and denied it any validity whatsoever. The Magna Carta, 1215, designed by Stephen Langton, the Archbishop of Canterbury sent by Rome, code law, to instill the Institutes of Gaius, the Justinian Code, the Roman law, so that all mankind would have no reference to God, to truth, to liberty, to freedom. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness would be gone forever in England. England was the last bastion, the last stronghold. But England followed a different pattern because one man, the Archbishop of Canterbury, a Roman Catholic, decided that the common law was greater than the Roman law. And because he did that, he changed England, which created America, which gave us hope today. You would have no liberty today had it not been for that man. But he's only one of many. You see, God is always able. He's a very enterprising fellow. He is always able to come up with a new plan to upset and overthrow the enemy just when the enemy thinks he's got it made. So Stephen rebelled against the Pope who appointed him because the Pope was a Nimrodian rebel. When you rebel against a rebel, you're actually godly. Jefferson made that our national motto, only it never made it. But he wanted it, and Benjamin Franklin agreed to him, that dissent against a tyrant is obedience to God. Or he actually put it, rebellion against the rebel, against the tyrant, is actually obedience to God. In other words, when you defy the enemy, you're actually obeying God. Did you all see that? It's the birth of dissent. You will not conform. You will not adhere to what you're told. You will do what God says first. The first four commandments is the duty that you owe to God. Madison said that a man, before he becomes a member of human society, and before he becomes a member of civil society, must first be a member of the universe, giving his duty to God. So the first four commandments ruled our founding fathers. And they believed that a man's allegiance would never be abridged by his civil duty, but rather your duty to God comes first, and it is all-encompassing. If there's anything left over, Caesar may have it. Render unto God what is God's, and to Caesar what is Caesar. What if God eats it all up? And Caesar would get nothing. But God gives Caesar something. Here's your little part. So give to Caesar what's his. Jesus said, show me the coin. Give him what is due. So you only give him what is due. But make sure you first give God what's his due. And he takes a lot. For example, he takes every conscience. I want every man's conscience. And I will brook no intermediary. No one will be able to judge a man's conscience. I didn't explain this morning, but we did at lunch a little, that Job had a conscience. And they were breaking his conscience with their code law. And Job stood up for the common law. And he said, you know, I don't accept you three judges, and I don't accept the fourth judge, because only God may judge my conscience. And you will not, with your religious and your moral and your civil nonsense, overthrow me. And so he refused to admit that he was guilty. Under your laws, you're not the lawgiver. God is. I'll let God judge me. Come forth, God. I didn't want to hear Elihu. I don't want to hear Eliphaz. I don't want to hear these other buzzards. I want to hear God, because my conscience belongs to God. That made America. That is what makes the church free. Otherwise, the church would be in bondage. Not only the conscience, but the exercises of that conscience. Free exercise will never come under the government in a civil law country with free men. So the res publica, the republic that we have, the public thing that we have, is a public thing. It's an open thing. It's something open to all. It's not going to be a thing of the king or a thing of the aristocracy or of the parliament or of the legislature or of the judicial branch. It will belong to the people. It's an amazing idea. And now it's being eaten up and swallowed up in TCU, SMU, and every U throughout these United States. Every law center, every law school is teaching now the code law, overthrowing the common law. But who will win? The common law. God has his ways which are hidden from you and I. That's why he said to you, seek first the kingdom. I'll give you everything else. Don't seek first the kingdom. You seek it last, you seek it second or third, I'll take it all away. I'll give you then your civil code. You want your oppression, you want your immorality, you want a government that will never work, you want to be destroyed, it's your choice. You want to follow other gods? You want to go after other gods? Then you will eat the fruit thereof. I give you the world. So today in America, there is probably no state in the Union except this state that will stand up and defy to the death that which God has given us, which no man may take away. Our laws are all on our side. Nevertheless, they change the laws so you don't even notice it. Little by little, they eat away with regulations. The IRS is nothing but a code. It's no law at all. There is no law, but it's treated as though it were a law because it's now under a civil law understanding. And all the other local codes and all of the acts of the legislature are no longer under the Constitution. They no longer obey the laws. They no longer care because they're under Nimrod. They're under man himself. If man is the measure of all things, then man shall measure everything according to the mighty ones. Might is right. Thus saith the emperor. But I defy you. David, King David, you remember he was a little boy at one time, he just 17-year-old brat. He said, you know what, you come to me with a big stick and spear and stuff, I'll tell you what, I come in the name of the Lord. And he knocked the guy down. Everybody said, what are you going to do? Put on some armor, buddy. He said, I don't need it. Give me a little stone, I'll knock that guy down. I've fought bears and lions. Oh, I see, all right. Well, go for it. And they knew they were going to be slaves. Would have changed all of world history. Magna Carta. King John, 1215, decided he needed some money. So he said to the nobles, cough up your feudal obligations to me, code law. Your feudal obligations to me, Roman law, canon law. You owe me. I am the one that holds your fief. I am the one that has your fee. Give to me. And they said, no. If you don't do it, I'll have to come and destroy you. I'll break you. He said, no, we can't do it. We have a law. What law? Magna Carta. I'm of course exaggerating this to make a point. So Stephen Langton went to bed that night. There was no Magna Carta. He went to bed that night and God woke him up in the middle of the night. And even though he was a Romanist, and even though he was a proponent, he had studied for 12, 15, 20 years, the Roman law, and he was well acquainted with it, went to school, knew it by heart. Yet he decided, you know, in England, I'm going to follow William the Conqueror. William the Conqueror, on October 13, 1066, the day before he had killed King Harold, an arrow went right through his eye. That was the end of Harold. I'm telling you, you got to watch out for those arrows. Well, William took over. He was the conqueror. It was all his. So he had to make a decision. Normandy, which is in France, the northern part, the Norsemen of France, Normandy was under Roman law, code law, civil law. Came to England, they were under Alfred the Great, 870. Alfred had set up his little law system. He used the Ten Commandments. He said, I'm going to have a law for Englishmen. Every man be free. I, the king, will not be the dominant tyrant, despot. I will be a servant of the Lord Jesus Christ. And I'm going to put Moses' law first. So the Englishmen were used to kind of being their own bosses, kind of ruling themselves under God. They liked liberty. They had that Norseman spirit. They had that old English idea that a man should be under God. And Alfred, they said, he'll be our king. Well, Alfred would go into a hut and he would say to the lady of the hut, hey, those biscuits look good. Now remember, he's the king. And she'd take the spatula, whack his hand, say, you can get your hands off of those. Maybe you're king of England, but in my house, I rule. He loved to tell that story. You see, a king is nothing but a servant. A king is a public figure. But we're under God. You see, God doesn't give up everything to the king. He only gives up something. And a king is only good in a time of war. And if he does a few other civil things, give him a few taxes, but nothing big, you know. Just enough to keep us defended. Why should he get involved with welfare states and all the nonsense that the modern world has gotten us entangled into? That's code law to break and to take away all that you have. The thief cometh to steal, kill, and destroy. You see why the scripture is much more than just spiritual. It's also quite practical. So, Magna Carta was followed. King John, of course, signed it because the nobles got together. He tried to beat them, but they won. Why? Because God was on their side. Why? Because when Philip Langton went to bed that night, the Lord woke him up and he said to him, "Hey, wake up." What? Turn to Isaiah. I believe it was 60 or 61 or 62. Doesn't matter. But he read it. And he said, "What am I reading this for?" He said, "This is what I'm trying to tell you." And when he read that, he stayed up all night. And he realized, you know what? I'm going to go to the king tomorrow, King John. And I'm going to present him with the Magna Carta, the Great Charter. Actually, what he had done was taken King Henry II's little bitty piece of paper with only a few things written on it, but nobody knew about it except Philip. It's a bit naughty. But he expanded a little bit, you know, added a few things that God put down. You know why? Because Henry II was the father of the common law. Remember I told you William the Conqueror on October 13 went into Westminster? I didn't tell you that part. Now I'll tell it to you. What he did the next day when he was the King of England, he decided that I won't follow the path of my ancestors who went to Spain and tried to impose Roman law on Spain. I saw that was a disaster. Now that I'm King of England, I will follow the law of Edward the Confessor, and I declare the common law to be the law of England forever. Oh my gosh. Right there, William, the bad guy, the conqueror, turned out to be a blessing. It all depends on how you're looking at it. He turned out to be a blessing because he established common law liberty for all those English folks. And one of his grandsons, great-grandsons, Henry II, he set it up in such a way that he wrote down all these common laws and established them, not as a code, but as a long-standing custom among the peoples, that law should not be something that judges make. It should be something not that legislators make. God makes laws. It should be something that judges write down when they make their little rulings for year after year after year, changed here, changed there, case by case, something unique, always fit to the justice that God in heaven would apply to that particular case before you. That's the genius of the common law under God. Always to seek for justice. No judge today seeks for justice. They only seek to apply the law over your case. The state, when you commit a crime, you don't commit it against an individual, you commit it against the state. Well, how is the state injured? What's a state? Where'd that word come from? Is that in the Bible? I think not. I think they know of nations, peoples, tongues, tribes, families, but states? Not at all. It's an interesting concept that I've now committed a crime against the state, and now the prosecutor will defend the state against your aggression. What did I do to the state? I don't even have to pay the person I hurt. I have to pay the state a fine. It's just a revenue collection. That is code law, but not under the common law. So you see, what he did that day on October 13, 1066, was to alter England forever. What? In keeping with his predecessor, Edward the Confessor. In keeping with King Alfred, his predecessor. In keeping with German Folkrecht. The Folkrecht came from Anglo-Saxon Germany. And that's how the English got their common law, year after year. And where did they get it? They got it because the scriptures came in and saved all those people. And so they built the common law on the scriptures, the Ten Commandments. Now, our nation today, and only here in Texas, did we defy the Supreme Court's ruling. The Supreme Court out there in, was it Georgia? Wherever Judge Moore is from or wherever else. And they began to make rules about you can't pray at football games and so on. Texas said, well, we're going to do it. We went and fought it all the way to the Supreme Court. We got our Ten Commandments back. The only state in the Union that could pull something like that off. Because we're a defiant bunch. We defy those that defy God. We believe in life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Isn't it exciting? Isn't that interesting? We don't believe that our betters and our superiors exist. We believe that we're as good as any other man. We believe that we may be ignoramuses, but so is everybody else. We don't believe in experts. We don't believe in pastors who are gods. We don't believe in popes. We don't believe in superiors. We don't believe in King George III's. We don't believe in great legislators and geniuses doing our city planning here in Fort Worth. We don't believe in Texas corridors. We don't believe in all kinds of things. We believe in the Almighty God and His duties, which create our rights, which necessitate our liberties. We believe that the duty is the greatest blessing that we could ever have. Because I owe a duty to God, I don't owe it to anybody else. In other words, if God claims something of me, I can't give it to you. God says my conscience is His, I can't give it to you. I can't give that to you. Well, tell me this. Wait a minute. Let's see if you have the right to ask me that question. I have liberty, you know. Liberty to do what? To do my duty to God. Well, what duty? Well, He wants my conscience. You can't have it. He wants my soul. You can't have that either. You can have some certain acts out of my body as long as they're within your little bitty teeny weeny realm. I just reduced by common law the imperial law, the Roman law, the canon law, all the laws of mankind that came from Nimrod. Nimrod's the first fellow that set it up, a law without God, because he himself became deified. The pharaohs were deified, sons of God. But we don't believe in such things. We don't believe like... You remember there was a king called Louis the 14th. Everybody remember that one? He's called the Sun King. He had a big sun behind him as though he worshipped the sun. And he said, L'état, c'est moi. The state, it's me. I don't know. That seems kind of arrogant to me. I don't know. It just seems like... It'd be like me saying, this church, it's mine. No, it's not my church. It's Jesus' church. I'm just an underling. I'm not even above you. I actually am a servant of you, the servants of God. I'm so low down. I have to serve the servants. You see, that's the way God sets it up. Where Jesus said, I came among you not as one to lord over you, like the rulers of the Gentiles. Code law. Civil law. No, I've come among you as one who serves. Well, I could be your Lord, but I won't do that until you voluntarily submit to me. And if you don't voluntarily submit, I won't command of you. I won't command of you. I don't want people to follow me because they have to. I want you to do it because you want to. You trust me. Put your trust in the Lord. Put not your trust in man. Put your trust in the Lord. Put not your trust in man. Put your trust in the Lord. Ten Commandments. Those are not commandments. I know the word commandment to you means something harsh. Like, if you don't do it, I'll beat you up. No. Commandment, actually, the word commandment is just simply the 10 words. Asara, 10. Words, the bar. Asara, the bar. It just means 10 words. And what it really means is 10 words from the Almighty to direct your life so that the blessings come to you. If you'll follow these 10 directions, these directives from heaven, if you'll follow heaven's rule, you'll be free. You won't be bound. You'll be free. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I'll tell you, I just love God because He's always for me. If God be for you, who can be against you? Code law will steal away like a thief. Don't just say, well, the devil's into politics. Yes, of course he is. But he will steal away everything if you don't take your duty. You have a duty not only to worship God, not only to love your neighbor, but you also have a duty to render unto Caesar what belongs to Caesar and render unto God what belongs to God. But you better render to Caesar what belongs to him. So you must be involved. Well, I vote sometimes. Well, that's not your duty. Your duty is not just voting. In fact, I don't even see that in the Bible. I see what it says. It says fear, honor, pay taxes, pay tribute. Well, there's quite a litany. There's what I owe Caesar. Well, I better do my duty. Because if I do my duty, I have a right to do my duty. If I have a right to do my duty, I have a liberty to do what I have a right to do. I don't have a liberty to do what I don't have a right to do. And I don't have a right to do what I don't have a duty to do. I have no rights except I have duties. And if I have a duty, I have a right. If you have the duty to come to this place, because your father said so, you have a right. You came on your own? Whew. That's powerful. That's powerful. It's wise. It's very powerful. But he has a right to do what he has a duty to do. But he's doing his duty voluntarily. Did you know you could do a duty voluntarily? Jesus said, I always do what my father wants. Isn't father going to beat me up if I don't do it? He wanted something done. I always please him. I always do what pleases him. You're pleasing your father. That's pleasing. That pleases your father. And that pleases your heavenly father. And your heavenly father who's pleased with you for pleasing him voluntarily, not by necessity. The common law is the law of freedom. It's based on the law of liberty. If the Son shall set you free, you shall be free indeed. That's not just spiritually true, that's also morally true, and that's also civilly true. Now do you see how the whole world is encompassed by the Ten Commandments? So now what has become an oppressive law is indeed quite the opposite. It's the means by which God sets you free. His law over you, his duty over you that he calls you to voluntarily, as he just so rightly said, that'll set you free from other men because I have already one master, I can't have two. I would gladly give you my tie and my coat and my car and my house, but I've already given it to God. Everything in this church we dedicate to God the minute it comes in. I don't get to spend a penny of it. Never have, never will. It's not mine to do. Belongs to another. Belongs entirely to God. And God gives it entirely to you. He doesn't even need any money. That's interesting. God does not even use earthly coin. You know that every penny that comes in actually doesn't go to God at all. It's just put into God's hand to dispose of as he wishes because he's the one that called me to do it. We don't get to decide. God decides. Isn't that powerful? And everything that God decides to do is on your behalf. Everything he does is for you. He created the world for you, redeemed the world for you. Now he sustains the world. Now he rules the world. Now he blesses you and benefits you. Everything is for your good. I tell you, there's a God I'd like to have. That would be a God. That would be a good God. God is good. God is great. He's not only good, but I'm glad he's also great because he might have to back that up against the enemy. The enemy would steal, kill, destroy, but God will kill the destroyer. God will destroy that which destroys me. Every weapon fashioned against you shall not prevail. So God has set up a new world order, the old world order. The new world order is rebellious order. Novus Ordo Secularum, that really is just another way of saying, let's go back to the old order. In other words, the new world order is, let's put God back in place. It was a revolution. You know what a revolution is? I wish I had something circular here I could show you. Anyway, a revolution, it's the only thing I can think of here. Let's say this is the top of the wheel. And I'm going to revolve it. Goes all the way around, comes all the way back to where it started. So a revolution is not a deviation. It's a return. The wheel always returns to the spot where it began. So a revolution, one revolution, starts it out where it rested here and ends up back in the same place. In other words, the way God originally started the world, we must return to. Then we'll go forward. You see how a wheel that is always returning to its original keeps going beautifully. It's a revolution, meaning it goes back to the original design, the original purpose. So our revolution, not the French Revolution, that was a terror. That was a destruction. That deviated from the original pattern. Ours went back to the original pattern. Ours went back to common law. Theirs went from Roman law to some kind of terror, to some kind of totalitarian Napoleonic code. Back to Justinian again. So the world can return to Nimrod, or it can return to the Lord Jesus Christ. O kings of the earth, be wise, God saith. Kiss the Son while he may be found, lest he become angry. The wrath of Jesus will be kindled someday, and that wrath, the wrath of the Lamb, will become the wrath of the Lion. And he'll come back to devour his foes. is a gentle lamb to us, but to the world he will be a fierce lion, the Lion of Judah, Yehuda, one who will triumph over all his foes and set us free. I hope you understand that the Bible is more than just spiritual. It also has ramifications in the moral realm, keeps your families together. It also cares about how you behave toward your neighbor, toward your enemy. It also cares how you behave toward Caesar. It cares about everything. So the common law is about to disappear from the face of the earth. But thanks be unto God for you people. You'll keep it alive, won't you? Is there hope? You don't even know what I'm talking about. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I know you don't know anything about what is the common law, a law that proceeds by prescriptive right, a law that takes the prescriptions that have been written over and over through long-standing custom, through ages and eons, the wisdom of the ancients. It's been gathered together in precedent. And the lawyer, when they practice their law, they look to that law, not as a god. They look to that law as a guide. But they never disregard it, as in code law. In code law, there is no reference to anything higher than the code itself. But in the common law, it always goes back to the law of the land, the law of the people, the genius of the people. If they're Christian people, it has to go back to Christian things. We are the Christian nation on earth. Where is Africa? Where is Asia? Where is China? Where are these other nations? They don't know Jesus Christ, but they're starting to know. You know why? Because of the freedom that was in this land to carry the good news that was to that land. Europe was once the bastion, the cradle of Christianity. At one time, Europe was the thing that God used to get it all started for everyone else. But now Europe has become enmeshed in atheism, and therefore that's why the Muslims have taken them over. The Muslims deserve to have them because the Muslims are code people. Code people take anyone who refuses the common law of England. England was the only nation in Europe. None of the other nations had common law. The Reformation would have brought it back, but the Reformation never broke with code law. In 1870, Germany was still under common law, Folkrecht. But in 1870, there was a man named Wilhelm II. And Wilhelm decided, I will unify all of Germany. Ah! So that was the way Germans do it. And so he unified everybody under the code that he established. It's the Prussian code. He pulled everybody together, and that's how Germany became a nation. Very sad indeed. Produced Adolf Hitler. It wasn't long before the Germans pulled everyone together only to destroy the rest of humanity by their code law. You cannot impose code law on a people except to enslave them and destroy them. You'll have no liberties left. So this is the greatest gift of mankind. What Nimrod started, we must overthrow. You know nothing about Nimrod. You need to know him. You need to know that this mighty hunter was an evil genius. Now I will prophesy to you. Even as Nimrod was a black man who led the world into idolatry, immorality, and injustice, the same thing that God had just destroyed the world for doing. And Nimrod took us right back. Noah's own grandson, his great-grandson. I believe and I prophesy that a black man will lead the world back to Jesus Christ. I believe God is right now preparing men from Ethiopia, that is, men from the dark part of the world. Could be in America, could be somewhere. But they come out of that family. They will lead us back to Jesus Christ. And I believe that now, even as it was in the beginning, so it will be at the end. God will again restore this threefold family back to its roots. Now remember the prophecy in Genesis 9, verse 27. If Japheth, us, some of us, if Japheth, the oldest son, will dwell in the tents of Shem, the second son, the spiritual, if the head guy, the smart guy, will get rid of his brains and stop worshiping his head, if he will submit to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, if he will submit to Israel's role, destiny, purpose, then Ham, Chem, will be his servant. Not as slave, as some have interpreted it. I told you that the only one that was cursed was Canaan, the white son, but never the black. Then, since there's no curse upon him, then God will give victory when the three sons come back together again. Shem, Ham, Japheth. Now, I believe God is about to do such a thing. As it was in the beginning, so it shall be at the end. So you're about to see the world turned upside down again. We've almost lost everything. And now just at the very end, when things seem lost and there's very little hope, it seems like we've lost everything. It seems like our enemies, I mean, America's divided right down the middle. We're all in a muddle. We're all confused. Why? Because of the churches. It isn't because of the bad politicians. It's because of the bad religious people. That is, the pastors are silent. The pastors have retreated into their four walls. They've forgotten about the God who is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of our Lord Jesus Christ, who is King of kings and Lord of lords, who comes not only against the idolatry of this world, but also against the immorality of this world, and also against the injustice of this world. Let righteousness flow down like rivers. The liberals are out. Code law is out. All those things. Can we do it? Is it hard? It's impossible. It can possibly be done. I can't even lift a stick. There's nothing we can do. But the God who woke up Stephen, and the God who produced the Petition of Right in 1628, and the God who produced habeas corpus, and the God who also produced, 10 years later, the great Bill of Rights from England, when the Glorious Revolution took place. Those four documents, those four common law documents created America. Without those, James Otis in 1761 would never have written and won his common law argument against the code law Britain. And he was able to forestall the Britons from coming over and the bishops from dominating us Nimrod style. That's why George III was stopped. And that's why Burke over in England, and why Pitt over in England, and why other friends over in England stood with us, stood against them. James Otis argued on the basis of Lord Cook, who was the great common lawyer, who put together the defense against the king, King James I. Remember him? King James Bible. And he was able to stop King James, who was about to introduce code law onto England, go back to the Roman Catholic Church, bring England under bondage, take us back to not only Jewish legalism, but Nimrodian paganism. We would have lost everything. But thanks be unto God, he always at the last minute raises up someone, raises up a clear voice, and establishes peace on the earth once more. Now, I don't know where you are. You may be depressed. I hope I encouraged you. I hope quite the opposite, that you see that God hasn't changed. Nothing's new under the sun, even though we're down to nothing, and all there is Texas. It's more than enough. More than enough. Yeehaw! Here the revolution begins. Write it down. The time has come for us to return to God's law, His Ten Commandments. The first four sets the second six in order. You cannot break the second six, your duty to your neighbor, until you break the first four. Every time you break one of the second six, you had to first break one of the first four. You cannot injure a fellow human being until you first defy the living God, and God won't have it. Therefore, He will raise up a standard. When the flood comes in, a standard is raised up. And we can thank some of our officials. I thanked the other night our Attorney General, Greg Abbott. I shook his hand. You remember that, David? I don't know if you saw me. Shook his hand and I said, thank you for rescuing the people of Texas and rescuing America. Why? Because he's the one that argued the case before the Supreme Court that the Ten Commandments, we have a right to put them up and we're going to do it. The Supreme Court agreed. He won that victory for us, taking us back to the common law, removing the ability of the United States to fall under code law. Powerful. He's a Christian. He's someone who understands higher law. And he argued in such a way that he reestablished the hope, the life, the liberty, the pursuit of happiness for us. And I'm finding as I go about that I'm favored. I get favor. David can tell you, wherever we go, we're given favor. Why? It's not because we're nice or good or smart. It's because God has a plan. It's because of you. It's because your prayers. We're winning. You need to know that we always win. No weapon fashioned against us can prevail. You need to know that God has a purpose. It's not for you to become a lord. It's for you to become a servant of the Most High God. So I hope you're blessed tonight. There's more to come. God bless you.